Brad.
Hi.
It's shaking.
That was interesting.
Oh, thank you. I was trying to make you feel. Just trying to make you feel warm, feel good today, you know?
Feel calm.
I saw a quote in my kid's school the other day. You know, I know I'm not supposed to be moved by elementary school wall quotes, but I was. I guess there's a reason that they're, you know, the old industry standards. And it was a Maya Angelou quote. And I don't remember exactly what it said, but the context was basically like, people aren't going to remember what you said to them. They're going to remember how you made them feel.
Yes, I know that quote.
And I took that a lot because, you know, I'd say through my life, my default has normally been talking.
Mm-hmm.
Talking in it, talking myself in it, talking myself out of it. You know, any number of ways where I thought the word itself could change the impact. When, you know, I probably should just hummed a beautiful tune and I would have gotten even farther.
Yeah. Maybe make everybody feel relaxed.
I don't know. Try to do something. So how you doing, Brad?
I'm doing fine. How's my buzz?
It's still buzzing, but it's okay as long as other people don't hear. I think Shane had it a little louder than you.
Yeah. But
it was nice to have old Shane on the podcast.
Yeah. We're talking about the fact that I was buzzing and that's why you don't hear me. I was muted. I muted right. myself.
Yeah. The reason you do not hear Brad through this podcast is we couldn't get rid of his buzz.
It's not because of all the sports talk at the top.
Yeah. Were you just like, oh, fucking Raptors. I'm out of here. This is bullshit.
I was there. I was looking over the shoulders.
I got to be honest, Brad. You know, once we started digging into this question, you know, and I know Shane had been asked it for a lot, many different times. But as we get into it, I'm really sort of fascinated on what is the actual, like, history of the Sing Scream. And, you know, like, who was the first to try it and who popularized it and who did it in different cultures and from punk to hardcore to emo. It's like I said in the interview, it's kind of a Raiders of the Lost Ark thing. I feel like once you open another door, you just get three more. I don't know the answer.
That could be a whole podcast right there. Musical history.
I think it could be a documentary. I believe.
Why can't a podcast be a documentary, Benny?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know how this works. I mean, I think you could sell me an NFT of this podcast.
Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. It'd be nicer to have some visuals to go with it. Yeah, that would make sense.
Sure. But I have a feeling like some people should get credit for it that aren't getting credit for it. Like what was going on with, does Iron Maiden get any love for that? Does Judas Priest, you know, does Sabbath? Like, you know, there was some kind of real aggressive stuff with singing, you know, like.
What about Little Richard?
Right. He's hollering all along. Is this a tale as old as time? And people have just, converted it in different ways for their different scenes.
Yeah. Truth.
What would you think is the first in your estimation?
The first, what's the definition that you're looking for?
I guess it was the first people to mold together, you know, really melodic singing and hardcore screaming at the same time.
So are you talking about the way that Silverstein or like, you know, that genre? So because for me, like they don't really, that's not, they're, Silverstein's not screamy to me.
Mm.
The way like a screamo band would be, I guess.
Mm. A little more melodic.
They're like, you know, I feel like when I hear the screaming in their songs, it's like I expect it there. But maybe right. that's... Yeah, they're melodic. You can listen to them and not feel assaulted.
Like, well, it's a tale as old as time, and I do feel that some of my New Jersey brethren deserve a little bit of credit for it. I know I mentioned some of this early on, but there's some bands around here. You know, Vision, rest in peace, Dave Franklin, and Turning Point, and Lifetime, and some of these older bands who kind of were doing it too. I bet every scene around America could, or around the world potentially, would have their version of who started this.
My guess is there's one or two obscure like hardcore bands from the 80s that you could trace it back to. Like, that's my guess is the old fart in the room.
We got to get into this one.
Nobody's coming right to mind, but you know what? I'll work on it. I'll think about it.
I love too that, you know, you never think, what are your thoughts on Metallica overall? You know, cause I have a fairly similar story to Shane. You know, it was his interview, so I didn't talk about it much, but Metallica was like one of my first entries into heavy guitar rock music where I was like, oh, what is this? And I do think they deserve a lot of credit for people my age for kind of turning our ears that way. Like, what were your thoughts on Metallica?
So, I mean, I remember when the Black record came out and it didn't sound like anything. It was one of those records that when you listen to it, you're like, oh, fuck, like, how is this going to impact us? And unfortunately, it directly impacted the Goops because the first thing it came out the week after we had mixed our first record, and the producer immediately went back and said, okay, we have to master this record so that it sounds like this Metallica record. Like, he wasn't going to go back and remix it. Yeah, wow. He was listening to like the low end and stuff. And I think as a result, our record got a little bit fucked up because I think he was trying to emulate something. And the record, I mean, our first record, I like it. I wish, you know, whatever. There's certain things about it. But like, I think that was a mistake to try to all of a sudden, you know, keep up with the Joneses. And like,
so you think from a production standpoint, that record just brought things to another level that it hadn't been before.
Yeah, and that was happening there's been records. What's the Foo Fighters record that has Monkey Wrench on it? That did
Color
the same.
And the Shape.
Yeah, so that did the same thing for a lot of like guitar rock. People heard that and were like, oh, how come we can't have our guitars louder than our drums and still hear the drums?
Right. Yeah, sure.
Which is almost impossible. I don't know how they have managed to do that on that record. But
and to bring up a deep cut to give them credit, doesn't Boston deserve some credit for that? Wasn't the album with More Than a Feeling like the pinnacle of recording technology at that point?
It was. That was like a record that was like definitely overproduced. You know, like I think the way that record was made was that Schultz?
I think that sounds right.
Guitar player. He had like a home studio, which was kind of unheard of. So he was allowed to basically like, you know, I think they recorded the drums and everything normally, like in a big studio, but he basically took tracks home and just like recorded them to death until he got exactly what he wanted.
That story actually goes deeper than that, Brad. I know a little bit about
you do.
What actually happened. Yeah. So they had, you know, that band and those songs was, you know, his brainchild. Yeah. And he was still working a job at MIT when they got signed.
Okay.
And what the label, he had a perfectly done demo with More Than a Feeling, all these things that he had done at his home studio that he considered perfect. But when they got signed, they told him, you need to go recreate this album exactly the same
at his studio,
at this fancy studios out in Los Angeles. So he sent like a proxy member of the band or something like out to LA to like start him. Correct me if I'm missing some details, but essentially he fooled the record label and made them think he was recording the record out in Los Angeles and actually had brought in all this stuff to his home to finish the record there.
Oh.
And apparently because of, you know, recording technology at the time, to get it out of his basement, he needed like a truck, you know, like a semi-truck that had to come to get like all the stuff and convert it from his basement out there. So that first Boston record was actually a dupe to the record label. And I believe what we hear on the album is mostly still recorded at his home.
So that sounds like a documentary as well, Benny.
Right. I don't think I have access there to the Boston stuff, but yeah, I would love to do some docs. I had thought of one this week. I don't know if you know the basketball player, Klay Thompson, but he's a very cool guy. He's got a great personality and he's been hurt for almost 2 years. And he plays for Golden State out in the Bay. And the thing he's taken to replace basketball was boating. And he bought a boat and started taking boats to practice.
Oh, really?
And I really want to get on the boat with Klay and find out his philosophies on life. That's the new documentary I want to work on. So anybody who's got some inroads to Clay Thompson or a documentary making, yeah. Oh, wait, I shouldn't have said this. Someone's going to steal my idea, Brad.
You kind of want him to steal it so you can see it?
No, I actually hit up somebody I know who has ties to the NBA the other day, kind of being like, maybe they think this is such a good idea, they'll do it with me. And their first response to it was like, I can't imagine how many requests Klay Thompson gets for stuff like this. And I'm like, oh, okay. Which means this isn't going to happen.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
But anyway, I want to thank Shane for coming on. Silverstein, 20 years of being a band, 10 albums. Like, this is one of those classic, like, people should listen to this interview as a, you know, these are telltales of what to do because they figured it out for themselves and they did it in a good way. And yeah, Shane's podcast is great. Lead Singer Syndrome. He really gets into it with a lot of different people and I like their new tunes.
Yeah.
So why don't we get into this? This was a fun one. So you are a Raptors fan, big Raptors fan.
I am a huge Raptors fan. And I'm not one of these, like, they just won a championship Raptors fans. Like, I went to the games when they played in the Sky Dome Stadium in the first year.
Whoa.
You know? Like,
What year was that? What was their expansion year?
1995.
Oh, nice.
So I was 14 years old, and basketball was literally my life. So for us to get an NBA team was, like, dream come true for me as a teenager.
And within the first 2 years, I mean, you're talking Vince Carter, Tracy McGrady, right?
Not even yet. I mean, if the first draft pick was Damon Stoudemire.
Right.
Really going back. And I remember the whole city was in like up in arms because they didn't take one of the O'Bannons.
Oh, Ed O'Bannon.
Ed O'Bannon or his brother.
Yeah,
that's right. And everybody was like, oh, this guy sucks. And then he ended up winning. Damon Stoudemire ended up winning Rookie of the Year.
Yeah, he was great.
But, you know, it was kind of because the team was so bad. Like, you know, it's like that thing, like somebody has to score, you know.
Yeah, he got a lot of reps.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm a diehard Raptors fan and this season's been a surprise.
Yeah, I actually in the preseason going into it, you know, I do a sports pod, so I was kind of doing my pre-rankings, and I think I had Toronto just on the bubble of being out of it, you know. I didn't expect the Barnes to be as good as he is, you know, Van Vliet to take a jump, you know, Siakam to, you know, kind of step up again the last month. I didn't really expect any of that. So yeah,
well, you know, they started the season without Siakam. You know, he's, you know, supposed to be their best player. And they were pretty bad out of the gate. So they, like, if you just look at their last, I don't know, like the last half the games they played, their record's probably really good. I don't know exactly what it is, but they've played well. And of course, there's been some issues with like teams not even bringing their whole team to Canada and, and stuff like that with COVID. So there's been some things that have worked in their favor, but I think the team is better than people think. They're not the Nets good, but,
Well,
it'll be all right.
That being said, if the Nets wind up in a series with the Raptors, Kyrie Irving cannot play because he can't play in New York and can't play in Toronto. So I don't know how that's going to go. Were you a
psycho?
Were you a basketball player at 14?
Yeah, yeah. So I was big sports kid. You know, grew up playing baseball. My dad's a huge baseball guy. In fact, he still runs an over 70 slow pitch league.
Oh, that is the coolest.
So he is.
Do you know the name of his team?
Oh no, it's had so many hilarious good ones. My favorite one, I think he was ever on. He was on a team called the Swill Hounds.
Yeah,
that was pretty good. But yeah, so I've always been around baseball, and you know, another, you know, the Blue Jays, 1992 and 1993, they won, you know, back to back World Series.
Joe Carter.
There you go. So, you know, for me, it was that the city was really alive with it. And I loved, like, I played baseball pretty much my whole life growing up, and I played basketball in high school. So yeah, that was, you know, and then punk rock kind of took over my life for a little while. And now I like both. So
yeah. And then you get, right. Everybody takes like the 10-year break from sports where you think you're like not allowed to do it because it's not that cool.
Exactly.
And then you're allowed like in your 30s again. You're like, oh, who gives a shit?
It's kind of accurate. I think for me, it was like maybe a 3 or 4 year break trying to get the band off the ground. But no, I've always, geez, I mean, like, just, I love the Blue Jays. Yeah. I love the Raptors. I love the Maple Leafs. So, well, you know, those are my teams.
In your estimation as an old school fan, I mean, why do you think Toronto is the only Canadian city that's really been able to keep, you know, American sports leagues and teams and actually do it functionally? Like, why hasn't that worked in other cities, you don't think?
Well, it hasn't been tried too much. I mean, obviously there was Vancouver with the Grizzlies, and that was, you know, well, there's the theory, right? That the only reason the Raptors didn't go the way of the Grizzlies in Vancouver was because of Vince Carter.
Right.
That guy just kept the team alive. Even though they weren't winning, everybody wanted to see that guy play.
You know? Air Canada.
That's right. That's right, baby. And that was important, you know? So I think that they got a little bit lucky with that. I think Montreal for the Expos.
Yeah.
It's just tough. It's not that big a market to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a little bit of, they didn't know what they had till it was gone.
Right.
You know, I think that Montreal could support a baseball team again. I think they could.
Seems like it.
But I don't know. Like NFL, you know, there's always been the debate of, will Toronto ever get an NFL franchise? Because it makes so much sense because it's such a huge city. Like, why wouldn't you have a football team? But we have our own league, right? The CFL.
Sure.
So then,
which is quite popular, right?
in Toronto, it really is not.
Oh, I see. Because I've been in the middle of Canada before where people are going ape shit about it. Yeah.
The Saskatchewan Rough Riders, the team.
That's right.
They're like the Yankees, Maple Leafs, and Lakers in one team. Like, that's how much bigger they are than all the other CFL teams. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
So
I didn't know they were they were the brass ring. I didn't.
It's all they got. It's all they got in Saskatchewan. But my favorite little tidbit of the CFL is that, I don't know what year it was, like when I was growing up. So in like the 80s, 90s, there were 8 teams in the league and 2 of them were called the Rough Riders. There were the Saskatchewan Rough Riders and the Ottawa Rough Riders at the same time.
That's tough. Do you know who was first?
I don't. And I just picture it like, okay, you can name your team anything you want, just not the Rough Riders. And them having a meeting being like, yeah, we're going to go with the Rough Riders.
That is too funny, man. So you grew up, wow, it turns out the Ottawa Rough Riders date all the way back to 1956.
Oh, the CFL's old.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't realize. Yeah. Look at that.
Yeah.
The Ottawa Red Blacks was their original name.
They're back to that now because they have a team again, and now they're the Red Blacks. I didn't know that that predated Rough Riders, so it's even stranger that they had a name change. But
yeah, and now I'm reading this, and does that mean that the CFL predates the NFL?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
yeah.
Wow, I didn't realize that. Yep. You know, Canada always does it right. So you grew up, in the Toronto suburbs or downtown?
Exactly. Suburbs. The city I grew up in is called Oakville.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 30 minutes from downtown Toronto with, you know, no traffic.
Okay. And is it the same deal around here? Like if you live that close, your parents work in Toronto?
Not my parents didn't. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. My dad worked in kind of another suburb.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, we grew up in, you know, my parents grew up in the suburbs on the other side of Toronto, on the Durham side is the name of it. And yeah, so that was home for me. And I had a pretty, you know, pretty normal suburban kind of upbringing, I guess.
What did Pops do for work?
My dad worked for the company DuPont.
Oh, okay.
You know, huge, I guess like chemical company. They make everything, right? Like,
yeah, yep.
If you drive by a house, you might see DuPont written on like the sides. They make like Tyvek and they make refrigerants, which I had a summer job working there one time when I was in university. My dad got me a summer job and I worked in the Freon department. Which was kind of random.
What happens at the Freon department at DuPont?
Not much, honestly. I was, you know, just a summer student.
Yeah.
And they had me do this. I built like a manual on like when they send someone to a job, what they do with the Freon.
Okay.
And it seemed like I was very, very not qualified to do something like that.
Yeah.
Like somebody's going totally fuck up an air conditioning system because I said to do this. Yeah. Like, what the hell do I know?
That sounds chemically serious for a walk-on job like that. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, you know, it's funny. That means your dad and Milo Ackerman have worked for the same company.
That's
a long
right.
time,
That's right. And I had Milo on my show.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that he worked there until I had him on the podcast. I was like, you're never going to believe this. My dad worked there for like 30 years. So
I got blown away too. Cause when I spoke to Milo, he had told me he lived in Delaware for a really long time. And I was like, why the fuck did Milo live in Delaware? It's like another Descendants record. Like Milo moves to Delaware. It didn't really make sense to me. And then he explained the whole DuPont thing and it made a lot more. And I had just recently seen that film. What was that film with Steve Carell where he played the rich DuPont man who tried to be a wrestler and ended up killing one of the wrestlers? Did you see this?
I have no idea. No, I don't. I missed this one.
It was like the first time everyone's like, oh, Steve Carell can act and go dark.
Oh.
I got to remember the name of it, but it was about that.
Well, when I was a kid, there was many conversations about the potential of moving to Delaware. Because that's for people that don't know, that's where the head office of DuPont is. So we went down there one time. I remember, I don't know how old I would have been, like 12 or 13.
Uh-huh.
And I was kind of at that age where I was like, you know what? I'm kind of down. Like, let's go. You know,
wow,
I was like, and it was funny because I told everybody, like my family might move to Delaware. And it's like the Wayne's World thing.
Of course.
Hi, I'm in Delaware. Cause that movie was like new at the time.
Yeah.
But I would have been down to do it. And I sometimes think about how, you know, my life would be different.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But
I know I go through that exercise all the time on tour. It's a strange thing to not think about, right? You go by these dusty towns every once in a while with like 50 people in it and just be like, wait, what if I was like 12 and I lived here?
Yeah.
Like, am I the same person? You know, am I a different person? It's kind of always an interesting exercise. Do you think if you were in Delaware, you're still a 20 year in rock and roll singer?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'd
hard
already
to say, right?
at the time I was already immersed in music. Like I think I was playing guitar and stuff. So, hey, maybe with, you know, Philadelphia right there, I'd get to be in one of like Dan Yemen's bands you know, be like a super cool guy. I don't know.
He could have been in Boys Sets Fire. I think they were in Delaware.
Yeah, right.
Like the only band I can think of that's from Delaware.
Pretty much. Yeah. I just talked to Nathan from Boys Sets Fire literally last week. So that's
awesome.
I love them.
So you were saying, you know, you were a real like, you know, baseball, basketball kid when you were growing up. So how did you get the sort of the golden ticket into, you know, punk rock and the counterculture? Like, when did that start for you?
Well, I have an older sister that is 6 or 7 years older than me.
Okay.
And, you know, so she always was like listening to cool music in her room and what I thought was cool music at the time, I guess, you know, like loud music because she had a stereo. And I remember I wasn't allowed to go in there. So she would crank up her stereo and like, I just hear her like dancing around her room. And, you know, it was like everything from Jane's Addiction to Depeche Mode and Erasure, like a lot of The Cure, like, you know, that kind of like, I guess you maybe you call it new wave or whatever. A lot of stuff like that. And one time she got this Metallica CD.
Ooh.
And I was like, what the fuck is that? Like, I never heard music like that before. And right away, I was sneaking into her room to listen to it.
And do you remember what was this Black album?
This was Injustice for All. So it was the song One was the first time I heard that, you know, rapid fire, like the ending with the, there it is.
Yes.
Yeah. The first time I heard that, I freaked out and I said to my sister, I said, what is that? Is that guitar? Is that drums? What is that?
Right.
She's like, I don't know. I think it's guitar. I was like, all right, I'm getting a guitar, you know?
And, oh, wow. Okay.
And well, my dad actually plays guitar. So we had like an acoustic guitar around the house.
Okay.
Which I thought was like kind of boring.
Are your parents musical at all? Like what's their kind of vibe?
Yeah, well, my dad plays guitar and piano, and I guess he was in a band when he was a kid.
Ooh. Do you know the name?
I don't. He told me one time it was something like Do He Does and the Don'ts or something, like some funny fucking name like that. But
so it's like super 70s.
Super 50s, honestly. My dad's 76, so.
Okay.
But anyway, my dad played, like, always was strumming guitar and like singing, and my parents both play piano. My sister plays piano.
Cool.
I don't play piano, which was kind of funny, but so we, like, pretty musical family and always enjoyed music. And my parents were playing, like, my mom really likes like Led Zeppelin and Hendrix and would play those records when I was a kid and stuff. But really it wasn't until I heard Metallica's One that I was like, okay, I want to do this.
Hmm.
And then it just got, just escalated into getting all the Metallica CDs. And then what's this Slayer band all about? And, oh, there's this other one called Pantera. Okay. And then, okay, I'm going to buy this magazine that comes with a CD, and then what's, like, you know, what's Cannibal Corpse and what's, you know, all those like Napalm Death and all these other, like, it kind of got more and more extreme.
Mm-hmm.
And then started finding out about local shows and going to, you know, see local bands. And where I grew up, most of the local shows were either like bad new metal, which I wasn't really into, or punk rock.
Okay.
So that's kind of when I started to hear about, you know, different punk bands. And I think that was around the time when Green Day and Offspring were getting really popular. So then I heard about, you know, Rancid and NOFX. And then from there, that was it, man. It was like all the Fat Records compilations and Epitaph bands, and Hopeless Records too was huge. Hopeless Records, to me, that early stuff doesn't get enough credit. Like,
what kind of stuff?
88 Fingers Louie, and one of my favorite. They were one of my favorite bands ever.
Yeah,
just the Hopelessly Devoted to You compilations. Like, those were my shit. Because, you know, in Canada, we didn't have. I shouldn't say this because it's not really true. Like, we could get records and CDs, but it wasn't as easy to get them as in the States, and they were just so expensive. So, So I did a lot of mail order, like mail ordered almost everything from Hopeless and everything from Fat Records when I was 16.
Yeah,
exactly. Cause it was like, you know, like 10 bucks for a CD and shipping was cheap. And that was like way better than going to HMV and paying, you know, $24.99 or whatever. It was like crazy.
So what was it like, you know, you're a little kid and you hear Metallica One. I also had a very, pretty cathartic moment with that song, and it actually had a lot to do with the video. It was like one of the first times I just saw like that kind of content on MTV that was like dark and broody and scary. And, you know, I had the footage from the Johnny Get His Gun video film, and Johnny, and it terrified me. And I was like, I don't think I realized you could mix like music and that kind of message until I'd heard it. So what was it like, you know, about you at that time that was like attracted to that kind of, you know, maybe energy, the heaviness, like the darkness? Was there like something that was pulling you another way, like when you were a little kid?
You know, I would love to say that there was, because that's like way better for entertainment, for a story, for like for fucking Kerrang magazine. Maybe right. Will put me on a cover if I say that, you know.
But the Shane told story.
Yeah, right. But honestly, like, no. I remember when my sister got the Black Album, because I think the Black Album was coming out and my sister was listening to Injustice for All, or at least the song One, like kind of getting ready for it.
Oh, okay.
I think it was around that time. Because when my sister got the Black Album, it was like, I couldn't believe it. I felt like I'd heard it before.
Mm.
You know, like it spoke to me in a way. Like, I remember that intro to Wherever I May Roam, that riff. Mm-hmm. Like hearing that, and just, I swear, like I had deja vu. And I didn't even know what that was. I was like 10, you know?
Yeah, and there's that big ass church bell on it, like, dung.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's so gnarly.
And so I don't know what it was that just, it spoke to me, you know, right away. And it was, I just liked it. You know? And I wish that I had, that I could say all these, yeah, I was like, had a, like, my parents are still together. They're going to be married for 50 years in May.
Oh, that's awesome.
50th anniversary in May, good, May 13th. Good. So like, I had a great upbringing and, you know, really nothing in my life that could be looked at as like really tough, which right. I know isn't great for an interview, but
no,
that's the truth, right?
And I appreciate it. Yeah, honestly.
And I love that. I just, that music just spoke to me. And you're right about that video too, because I remember hearing, like, they actually had other audio dubbed over the video that's not in the song
right.
on the record,
right,
which I thought
right,
was
right.
so crazy and like pretty cool at the time. It's still pretty cool, actually.
Yeah. I mean, isn't he in that video? He's literally like saying, kill me in Morse code. Like, that's some rough shit for daytime MTV. like when you're like 11. Yeah, it's brutal. Well, I think that's good. And actually, when you say that, it makes me think, you know, through the years, I've seen so many people have to like put themselves through the ringer to perform or to create, you know, and they right. feel like it has to come from this place. And then so many people wind up on the other side as they get older, where they're like, you know, I kind of wish I didn't approach it like that. And there is actually a way for me to be a creatively active person and not fucking miserable simultaneously.
Right.
And I think it's a nice story to hear every once in a while that you like, you don't have to do that. Like, you don't have to go through pain or agony, or you don't have to have this thing to actually be a very prolific and creative person, you know?
No, totally. And I mean, sure, I went through the pain and all that later. That still happened.
You're not free of it.
But when I was, you know, 10, like I didn't have, you know, thank God I didn't have any, you know, any sort of abuse or any like right. things like that happened to me. Cause you know, I hear the stories all the time about how many people close to me went through these awful, awful experiences when they were a child. And I feel lucky. The more older I get, the more lucky I feel that I, you know, had really good surroundings,
sure.
a really good family and extended family and, you know, some great people in my life.
I mean, as far as your lyrics are concerned, it would, you know, allude to me that you're a empathetic person in general who can just kind of not only see, but maybe feel the pain a little bit of people around you. So,
that
can be just as useful as an exercise and experience, right?
Yeah. No, a lot of the song, for example, the song My Heroine, one of our most popular songs
right.
was
yeah.
I wrote that about a friend. I went to his house to kind of check on him because he was going through a dark time, and I was like, dude, it's like a fucking heroin den in here. You know, like it was like, you know, and that's kind of what inspired me to write that. It was
sure
another person's sure struggle. So yeah, absolutely, that happens all the time. And sometimes it's weird because you can get a different perspective when you're looking at something from that angle than when you're involved in it. Sometimes when you're involved in it, you're so close to it.
Yeah.
It's hard to almost explain it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, that's true. Cause you're not coming with it from it's not too overcome with emotion, right? I guess. I guess it can be. Maybe
it's
not so
different.
Much.
Yeah. You can just see it from kind of both sides. Like, it's like a narrator, you know, in a movie explaining something better than a character could, you know?
That's interesting.
That's sometimes, I think, what happens. But then there's other times when you'll write something that's just so in your own feeling and in your own moment that if you get it out right, so many other people have gone through that same feeling or that emotion that if you can describe it the right way, it can resonate so well with so many other people too, which is an incredible talent that some people possess, you know?
Yeah, 100%. So, I mean, moving ahead a little, like, you know, in Toronto and the area, when you all were coming up, there was sort of a very vibrant, you know, scene with that kind of music, right? Like Alexis on Fire, Monin, Boys Night Out, like those kinds of bands. Like, you know,
the big four right there. I'm just making this up right now, but that's funny. We could say that we were the big four of the Toronto suburbs in 2004.
I mean, I'm an old school hardcore kid, so for me, it was like Chokehold, New Day Rising, Grade, you know, like all that stuff. But
you know, Did you know New Day Rising's back?
I did actually hear about that. New Day Rising was like one of my favorite deep cut bands that you like discovered through 7 Inches and videos of like random festivals, but I never actually saw them like in the flesh. But their split with Despair was a very, very important 7 Inch to me. I love the New Day Rising side.
Man.
So what was going on at that time? I mean, it seems like everyone was sort of fueling each other and kind of had this really like vibrant community going on. Was it the same for you being inside of it?
Yeah, it really was. You know, I think it was so cool. And I think the only thing was, I definitely took it for granted a little bit. I think I didn't realize until we started touring and going other places that our scene was special.
Right.
And, you know, I knew about, of course, like you can talk about New York or New Jersey or, you know, all the random pockets that have great scenes all over the place. Like those exist. And I just kind of figured like everywhere had that.
Right. Yeah.
But then when growing up, like, we'd have a show, local show, Friday night at the local YMCA or community center. There'd be like 300 people, and it didn't matter who was playing, you know? And that doesn't happen. And I just thought that kind of happened everywhere. Oh, yeah, you'd be in a band, you go on tour, and, you know, you just people come.
Right.
until we're in Little Rock, Arkansas, and there's like 15 people there, know, and we have a record out on Victory, like then it's like a rude awakening as to, you know, how things are. So I think it wasn't until that I was like, wow, we had not only so many people excited about what the bands were doing, but so many great bands too. And I think just the scene just kind of fed off each other, you know, like you had to be pretty good to kind of be in the same world as these bands. So it was no surprise that you know, the four bands you mentioned all did really well for a long time. And then, you know, there's so many bands that I could name that just kind of never just didn't make it for whatever reason, you know.
Who's your favorite band that like we haven't heard of?
There was this band called The Stick Up.
Good name.
Super short lived band. They had an EP which I helped put out actually. And they were kind of like an all-star band, bunch of guys from a bunch of different local bands that were all really good. And they just made this awesome, like 6-song EP. And Epitaph was interested in them. So like sent Epitaph like the CD or whatever. And then Epitaph was like, yeah, it's good. But like, yeah, just like, we're just not sure right now. Like just dragged their feet on it.
Yeah.
And the band was like, ah, fuck this. We're breaking up. I guess we're no good. And it's like, that's not how it works. Like, you know, like you just, and the singer like moved to China and became like a, you know, like a teacher over there or something. So it just was like one of those things where if the band just didn't get frustrated and just continued, think about how much better they would have gotten everything. Cause all they ever released was 6 songs and there were 6 bangers. So there's tons of stories like that from all over the place.
Sure.
you know? Because I've always said, like, I believe the best song, the best songs, the best bands ever out there, none of us have heard them. You know,
right,
think about how many people have sat in their bedroom and wrote this like incredible song and just nobody ever heard it.
Yeah. Or you just have to assume that, like, you know, every scene that gained a lot of notoriety or, oh, what is this music that somebody's playing? I just always assume the person or people who started doing it first, like, died broke,
right,
and hungry. And then all the, like, it's always the second generation that gets the spoils of the work, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Thank God for the band Grade, because without Grade,
right,
where's Silverstein? We don't exist. So straight up, you know, that's like, that was the band that I saw play that I said, this is the band for me. Like this is, I want to do this. This is the most inspiring band for me. So that's my biggest influence.
Yeah.
Definitely Grade, local band that put out some very good records on Victory and just kind of, I don't know, they just broke up, unfortunately.
Yeah, great. I think, you know, it's interesting you brought that. I wanted to talk about it later because, you know, Grade was one of the first bands for me at the time that I thought really effectively was like, because, you know, at the time when most people in the hardcore scene tried to sing, it didn't go all that well, you know, like more often than not.
Yep.
And, you know, for me, with the bands that I was into, like Grade and Boy Sits Fire were the first two where, you know, they're going into these parts where I'm like, oh shit, like they're singing, like he can really sing. This is different, you know?
Yeah, totally.
And I remember hearing Separate the Magnets for the first time and that shit put me on my ear down in New Jersey for sure. Cause we were part of that scene too. Like, can you talk about Grade a little for people who may not know him? And then I'm also curious to you, like, as we just alluded to, who do you think was the real like predecessor to this type of music? Like where was Grade getting it from? Where was Boy Sits Fire getting it from? Like, what were the things that actually started this? I know this is kind of like a Raiders of the Lost Ark sort of question at this point, because, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of different theories or places, but where do you think it like really stemmed from?
Well, first of all, I think of bands that influenced Grade. I'll talk about, you know, Grade and pretty much they're a band from Canada, a local band that were kind of to me, the first band where the singer did both the singing and the screaming.
Mm-hmm.
And he was Kyle Bishop's his name, just such a dynamic front man, like just stage presence. He has stage presence like fucking Mick Jagger, you know?
Yeah, he had like great hair, right? Like even in the 90s.
Yeah. Like Grade honestly paved the way for 18 Visions and Fashion Core and all that, like that whole thing too, you know? And that was Kyle, like to me, single-handedly. But I got to say, knowing Kyle and knowing how deep how big his record collection is basically, but just the kind of person he is, I honestly have to give them a lot of credit for starting that.
Nice.
And I don't know if Boy Sits Fire, what they would say, you know, and I just talked to Nathan, I should have asked him, but you know, what they would say they got it from. But I think we found the same thing happened when, you know, we emerged and then everybody was like, oh, you sound like this band Senses Fail from New Jersey. And we're like, well, I don't know, I guess kind of like, but why? Because we never talked to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't know anything about them. And we just kind of came to the same conclusions about where music was going, right? And we'd heard the Get Up Kids and then we'd heard Poison the Well, and then somehow that's kind of what our bands sounded like, you know, if you kind of mash those up in a soup. So, you know, so I don't know. That's tough to say though, because for me, a lot of the bands that kind of came before that were either hardcore bands or weren't. And it's hard to think of what was the band that Boy Sits Fire and Grade kind of got it from, and I don't really know if there's an answer. If there's one band or something, you know.
I'm going back in my head like right now, and I'm thinking, you know, what were the heavy bands that sang ever? And there was an element of that in like the 80s New York hardcore scene. You know, a band like Leeway or those bands were, I mean, it was coming from a metal point of view, not, you know, a very melodic point of view, but they were screaming, singing, you know. And then I think about maybe some of that, you know, early West Coast stuff, you know, Dag Nasty.
Yeah.
Dag Nasty. Early Pennywise, going into the Jersey stuff, like Lifetime, Turning Point, Vision, you know.
I think Lifetime definitely is a great band to bring up, and they're one of my favorite bands ever because they kind of were blending that, but obviously, like, they weren't doing the chug thing.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And got so away from like, it even more as
it was
they
kind
grew,
of
yeah.
exactly. So kind of blending in some of those like melodic hardcore bands. Dag Nasty is a great example too. Yeah. So I mean, even Gorilla Biscuits, like,
right. Yes.
Has singing, you know,
Civ
it's
in
not
general.
Screaming.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like even that, it's just like, okay. And then by the same token, you know, 10 years after that, or 10 years after Grade heard Gorilla Biscuits or Leeway or whoever, I heard Grade and said, okay, I want to do that, but I want to sing like Newfound Glory. You know what I mean? I want to find what's the next step here.
Right. The next evolution of it. Yeah.
And that's kind of where we came in. Mm-hmm. And now, I mean, now it's on a whole new level, you know,
20 years later. Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
yeah. So how many, generations of the fold have gone past you now? Like, is there like two more scenes since Silverstein started now?
I've lost count.
To muddy this question even further.
It's so strange though, right? How everything is just like exploded in so many directions. Like, is there a scene anymore?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Right? Like, it used to used to be that there was, you'd hear a band, someone would play you a record and you'd be like, oh yeah, this band's probably from New York. Or you hear this band and you'd be like, oh, this band's probably from California.
Right.
You know, now you hear something.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And it's like, I don't know, Ohio? Like, yeah. It's like, nope, it doesn't matter now. Like, sounds don't dictate. But I mean, areas don't dictate sounds really anymore at all.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
So I don't know.
That concept of the local scene, you know, well, obviously they still have local scenes, but yeah, like you're known to people all over the world before people next door even know who you are at this point.
That's wild. When you hear about bands playing their first show and there's like 1,000 people there sold out. Like,
yes. I try not to judge. I mean, it's so antithetical to like the way we did it or I did it. But you know, I also am like, hey, like if you didn't have to do all that bullshit, good for you. Like, it's like, it's like those people in the States who are like, we shouldn't pay for old student loans because I had to pay mine, you know?
Right.
Like I'm okay with people getting the, you know, a little bit of an easier road if they need to. The one thing I'm curious about, because you have sort of the double insight for the fact that you are a singer, but also somebody who, you know, does a podcast for many years, yeah, interviewing other singers. And, you know, one of the things that always fascinates me is like sort of the, you know, the psychology of people getting into this. And, you know, I was wondering, after all this time, you know, for yourself and speaking to other people, what are some of the real consistent threads you've seen with the really prolific and successful singers, and really some of the consistent threads you've seen for the ones who struggle personally and maybe like go off the rail?
It's a great question. And yeah, damn, dude. And it's true. I have been doing a podcast for a long time. I have episode 300 coming up next week.
Nice. Congratulations.
Yeah. I have Jake Bannon from Converge, which I'm pretty,
excited
about that one. Yeah. I'm stoked on it, but no, to answer your question, I think, you know, the people that when I say, okay, I'm going to call you at this time, and they answer their phone and we do the podcast and they don't like say, oh, sorry, I forgot, or like, oh, I got to reschedule. Generally speaking, like, those also is pretty tied to the level of success. I hate to say it, but, and I think it just goes, it really comes down to how much work and care that people put into it.
Wow.
And I know it's an easy answer, but just so much of the time, that's what I see. You know, people take it seriously, every single thing they do, and they work hard on it, and they seem to reap the benefits of it, you know? And the people that don't or don't care or you know, say whatever, those are typically the people that do, you know, that's just what happens. And it's amazing how much in music these days is about that. Because I feel like coming up, you know, you put out a record every couple years, you tour, and then, you know, now it's like every day you need to be working on something.
Right.
You want to, you like people, you have to stand in front of people's faces, whether it's like, you're working on social media, you're working on this other project, or you're doing something. Like, if you want to be a working musician and you want to make a living at this and you want to continue to grow, you have to work hard at it.
Yeah.
And some people don't have that in their DNA. And that's why a lot of people kind of just, they've fallen to, you know, out of relevancy. It's sad to say, because some they're still very talented people.
Yeah, right. Do you believe that to be a, like a core principle in somebody? Like, some people are just know how to work and know how to buckle down, and some people don't? Or do you think these are skills that somebody could pick up if they were focused on it?
I think so. I mean, I think definitely it can be something that can be picked up, or some people just need some help.
Right. Like knowing where you're bad and asking for some help.
Yeah. Knowing where you're bad, or having a person in your band or a manager. Like, some people need that stuff, you know? I'm pretty hands-on with everything I do. You know, I do the podcast basically 100% myself. I have an editor now, which is really great, but
that's cool.
For years, you know, I did everything from the artwork to the scheduling to the editing to the, you know, writing the fucking description, which is my least favorite part.
Yeah, and your Patreon is very nice, and it kind of makes me feel a little inadequate about ours, like, I'll be honest with you.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I do all that stuff myself, and that's great, but, you know, I've renovated a fucking house this week too. Like, I'm go with my life, and that's how I choose to live. But some people, like, they need help. They need someone to help them with all these things, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Sure.
But you just need to recognize where you're at with it, you know?
I think
that's a big thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, I mean, that's part of your nature, where you kind of have to be driving and working all the time. So I can imagine, it seems as if, you know, COVID was sort of the first time in your adult life that you were operating without tour and in and out as part of said life. So Did you see any real changes to yourself, positive or negative, as a result?
Not really. I think myself, along with most of the world, just kind of had a freak out where at the beginning, you know, we got stopped in the middle of a tour, you know, 20th mm-hmm. anniversary
yeah,
tour,
right.
10 shows in. Okay, go home.
Yeah, I saw right on Rudy Gobert Day, right?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Rudy March 11th, Rudy yep. Gobert Day.
That's right. Yep. And we had to go home and it was like, okay, well, there's our money for the year. You know, basically it's like our biggest tour ever to date.
Right. Yeah.
And you just start to worry like, okay, now what? What, you know, and it's like, okay, well, I've got this podcast and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do this. And I just started saying yes to like every single thing because I thought I needed to, you know?
Right. Because yeah, you had to fill that bucket. Like,
right. Like, yeah, well, yeah. I'm home. I need to be doing something. And yeah, I'm like worried about finances, even though I had no reason to be worried about finances or anything like that. I just, you know, you don't know how long this pandemic's going to last and you don't know. I mean, if I knew it was going to be this long, I'd probably be freaking out more.
Yeah, but, well, yeah, right.
Right. But I mean, you know, so yeah, I honestly just did so much shit that it was a little overwhelming. And some of it's been great, you know, like getting into things like Twitch and, you know, some of the other stuff I've done, like some of the, you know, songwriting and stuff I've done with some other people, like that stuff's been really great. But if I had to go back, I'd be like, man, I should really be enjoying this break.
Right.
Because I could have enjoyed a break. And instead of not having to go on tour for a year and a half, I like just killed myself, you know, at home.
Right.
And now I'm always trying to kind of adjust and figure out, okay, what is a like healthy amount of projects on the go and what should I do and what should I say no to and, you know, that kind of thing. Cause it can be a challenge because I got a lot of things going on.
Sure. I mean, that being said, you know, obviously you jumped into, you know, you were one of those bands, right, who almost not started on the internet, but a lot of your early success, right, was on like MySpace and some of the early web pages, right? And now, you know, you guys are heavy into live streams and you're doing the thing. And, you know, what do you think is the balance for bands and people our age, kind of between like aging gracefully, but also using these services like to our advantage?
You're right. Yeah. Nobody wants to be the like Steve Buscemi with a skateboard. Right. Hello, fellow kids. Hello, like that kids. Meme, you know,
but, I'm on TikTok now changing my daughter's diaper. Like, yeah.
Right. Yeah. There's a certain level of cringe that I don't want to enter.
Yes. Yes.
You know, in these,
so
various,
where's that line?
Various platforms. Me. It's Benny, that's a great question. And you know, the truth of it is like, I couldn't fucking believe when our drummer Paul made us a website in the year 2000. Okay.
Right.
I was like, what the fuck do we need a website for? You know?
Yeah.
Like that was honestly like, what? Like bands, like I guess Metallica has a website.
But yeah.
Like,
right. Yeah.
Why do we need a website? So, you know, there was a lot of that. And I got to give him some credit for, he's our manager and also like always pushing forward with things.
That's cool.
And we were one of the first bands to sign up for MySpace. So we were at the top of all the fucking lists.
Right.
That was part of it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we weren't really like, people want to say, oh, we got big on MySpace. It wasn't really true. Like we were on MySpace and, you know, I'm sure it helped our popularity, but like, you know, before that we had already put out two pretty big records on Victory and
we were already
selling out House of Blues rooms and stuff, but
that's true.
But I will say we have always embraced and not shied away from the new things coming out.
Right.
You know, like we got an Instagram account when that was a thing. And I mean, I guess the only one now we're like kind of, have a little bit of trepidation about is TikTok.
Right. Yeah.
I just don't know if I have the capacity to do it, you know, but
yeah.
But that being said, I think every step of the way, we're thinking about it and we don't want to, you know, it's not just missing opportunities, but, you know, we're not, we don't want to be like this jaded old band that says like, oh, back in our day,
right,
fucking MySpace was the best. Like MySpace was cool, but MySpace wasn't that great.
No, it was fine.
It was fine.
It served a purpose. Yeah. That's cool. So Shane, this is the part of the podcast called Mystery Friend. Where I went ahead and talked to somebody you know.
Oh, cool.
Got some stories. And I'd like you to regale me with these stories and then guess which one of your mystery friends told me.
Oh, man.
So the first story in question, which I am quite excited to hear about, happened, I believe, in around 09 at the Higher Ground in Burlington, Vermont. And apparently it was a bit of a sleepy night. And someone went ahead and took a neon letter from a Quiznos sign or something, put it in the bus. And then I heard all night long, people were saying, you got subbed. So can you tell me a little bit about this?
I knew right when you said Higher Ground that it was going to be the Quiznos sign. Yes.
You got subbed. Yeah.
So. And I thought to myself, was it Quiznos or Subway? That entered my head just now. And it was Quiznos. Does anyone eat at Quiznos anymore? That place was pretty good.
I went there once and I was like, Jesus, did you just heat up my fucking lettuce? And I never went there again.
Oh.
Yeah.
No, they put the lettuce on afterwards. But I feel like that was one of those places that had mad hype and they opened like all these locations and they just all closed.
That seems right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That seems right.
Okay. Yes, we were in Vermont. It was the first day of tour.
Oh.
So we were all like a little excited, you know?
Yeah, right.
One of those kind of things.
Got the ants in the pants. Do you remember who you were touring with?
Ah, God. I want to say it was like a B market tour or like we were doing like one-offs or something.
Okay.
But you know, I can look up the Silverstein tour archive and I can tell you exactly. Because we have a very cool thing on our website. We were just really excited. And I remember we, I don't think I was there. I think I might have been trying to do the lead singer thing.
Right.
And like, you know, sleep. But I remember hearing the commotion and I definitely saw the Quiznos letter at some point.
So somebody took it and put it in the bus?
Yeah. In someone's bunk.
So like they were surprised by a Quiznos letter in their bunk. Oh,
yeah, like
so
they
funny.
Went. They was like, it was like, hey, and I'm trying to remember who the fuck it was. Like, I'm trying to think of who was touring with us at that.
I heard it was in your old guitar player Neil's bunk.
Oh, okay, then that's what it was. So yes, we were all hanging out, and the I think this sign letter was in his bunk, and it was like, hey, Neil. Are you feeling a little tired? Maybe you want to go to bed. So that when he opens his bunk curtain, there's the letters there. And then it's like, okay, now what are you going to do with it?
So what did happen with it? I mean, it's not like you can just drive around with that letter, right? You could get arrested.
Well, I want to say that the bus letter was taken out of the bus before we departed.
Okay.
I don't think we took it to another city, but I think it was like on the ground. Like, I don't think someone like took it from the Quiznos.
Okay. So this,
like,
this
climbed
was,
up
yeah,
and stole it.
This was going to be my follow-up question. I mean, the letter in the bunk is one thing, but how did it get there? I mean, that's kind of the bigger question. Like who got it?
No, I think it was like a broken, fallen down Quiznos sign, which maybe that was foreshadowing for the entire Quiznos franchise and how far they've fallen.
Because I was picturing like Bill up on a ladder, like, you know, disconnecting disconnecting a neon sign or something, you know.
No, but that's we don't put that past us.
All right. I got the You Got Subbed story. That's okay. Funny.
I don't remember the You Got Subbed, but that's yeah. really
so
good.
Apparently that's what everybody was yelling out is You Got Subbed, which I appreciate. And then the other story I'd like to hear about apparently was in Vienna, Austria, about a year later. And I heard that you all ran upon a Krampus Day parade.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yes.
Because someone just filled me in on the real story of Krampus, and it's creepy.
Yeah. So actually, it was not Vienna. It was Austria. I believe it was either Linz or Graz.
Okay.
And we were on tour with Billy Talent. And we had a day off. It's a huge tour. And we're just like chilling, you know, like getting beers or coffees or buying shoes or like whatever you do on a day off on tour in Europe.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, there's just these monster people everywhere, like looking all menacing, like if anybody knows what the Krampus like looks like. And they're just like running around the streets and like hitting people with branches, like sticks.
Oh my God.
And like sometimes it's pretty hard.
Like random unaffiliated people.
Yeah, just people like hanging out. So like some of us like got hit with these and what? And there people are like everywhere. So we were like, what the fuck is going on? Like, what is this? Is this a thing that you know happens in like the city? Like,
right.
Or whatever? And it just happened to be that one day a year that they do this.
Wow.
And it got pretty gnarly though, because I guess it's like, look, what do you have in New York when everybody dressed up like Santa Claus? What's that called?
A Santa Con.
Yeah, and everybody like, but people are all like drunk and like doing bad shit, right?
Worst thing ever. Yeah.
Yeah, worst thing ever. So I guess that's the knock with this is that it's the same thing. Like people are all liquored up and wearing masks, and like so this one, like we were just standing there like looking around, like what the hell is this? And this woman got like hit with the branches, you know, like on the back or whatever, and she pushed the Krampus, and the Krampus smoked her in the face with the branches. And it was like gnarly. And I was like, we were like, oh shit. Like this is kind of like, you know, it's like, it's weird though, because the Santa thing, it's like, okay, it's like you're dressed up as Santa, like ho, 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 like jolly.
Yeah. Those are just like drunk dressed up idiots, like fucking bar crawling. Yeah.
Yeah. But these are drunk idiots wearing like monster costumes, which is like kind of fucked, you know?
Yeah. It's like a Guar concert, like gone out of control.
Yeah,
like,
kind of. Yeah, it kind of looks like Guar a little bit.
Was like, it kind of menacing? Because like I've seen these pictures of, you know, the Krampus actually looks a lot like, I don't know if you've, it's what we named the hockey team after. There is an actual tale of the Jersey Devil in New Jersey. And that's what the hockey team got their name from. And it was this, I've read a couple books on the Jersey Devil, and I do think he was real, and it was sort of like a half horse, something animal that lived in the middle of nowhere, looked really creepy, had kind of like the forked tongue, the one hoof, the one human foot, just like Krampus. Very creepy stuff.
Yeah.
So that sounds sort of menacing.
Yeah, no, totally. And yeah, I don't know exactly when, like I think it's like a day that they do it.
Wow.
Yeah. Every year in early December. Every year in early December, they do it in Austria. So, yeah, so we happened to be there that one day, and yeah, it was pretty wild.
How about now? Like, what are we talking? Like, how many Krampuses are we talking about?
Oh, hundreds.
Whoa, hundreds.
Yeah, hundreds. Yeah, it was like all over the city. Like everywhere you looked, they were.
So
like,
it's not
around.
Like you could have fought back at the Krampuses after hitting you with a stick. Like what?
No.
What do you think would have happened in the, you know, say a shitty American like me was sitting there, and got hit with a stick? And my shitty American mentality popped in, and I started fighting Krampus. What do you think would have happened? I've been beaten by like 50 Krampuses?
Probably, yeah.
Wow. Krampus beatdown.
Like, you're like, I think you're supposed to kind of know, okay, they're going to hit you, and it's like, that's just the thing.
Yeah.
But it was, some people definitely were like hitting people too hard, and hitting people that didn't want to be hit, and we saw it escalate.
Wow.
Like a couple times, but that was the worst one when the girl got hit in the face. I was like, oh my God.
Yeah. That's really crazy. And so random. Like I remember, one time in Holland, I saw those very controversial Black Pete parades, you know, where they, I don't know what they do it every year, but I'm sitting there one day and I'm like, Jesus Christ, is that like a dozen fucking Dutch people in blackface?
Oh,
and
man.
I was like so horrified. I
don't know anything about that. Yeah, that's weird.
It's a custom they have there that a lot of normal people are trying to get rid of, and you know, old people who, well, you know,
ooh,
to conserve is a word inside of conservative.
I'm reading about it. No, this is gnarly.
Yeah,
no,
it's not good. No, not good. Not and good. I actually saw it and I was like, what the fuck is happening, without knowing anything about it. Okay. Oof. So
yeah.
Who do you think told me these stories? You got subbed and the Krampus parade.
So because I know your relationship, I am going to guess that it's Mr. Danny Del Principe.
Oh, you gotta go even deeper.
Not Danny Del Principe. Okay. I'm going to go
You're
with...
You're in the right genre.
Joe Amato.
That's it. Jersey Joe.
Joe Amato. I love Joe Amato.
Oh, he's my favorite person.
Have not talked to him in a very, very long time.
This is how the conversation goes with Joe yesterday, because you'll appreciate this. You know, Joe is one of the most anti-New Jersey people you'll ever meet, because he's a true New Yorker who actually, you know, they have this bizarre idea about New Jersey. And, you know, he moved to New Jersey. So, of course, to me, his new nickname is Jersey Joe, you know, because I got to fuck with him. And I hit him up yesterday. He still has his New York area code. And I'm like, look at this, Jersey Joe with the New York area code. He goes, when I die, take me and that phone and roll me back over the border. So that's the man we're talking about.
That's really good. Yeah, that sounds perfect. No,
classic.
Absolutely love Joe. Yeah. And he's not like a social media guy.
No, not at all.
So I kind of feel like that's, yeah, I don't really keep in touch with him, unfortunately.
No social media, a green texter. If you want to talk to Joe, you got to give him a call, you know?
Yeah.
Old school. Yep. He's always old school.
I don't mind it.
Well, that was fun.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to get, you know, Silverstein, I honestly hadn't even realized, you know, how prolific of a career you've all had, you know, since we were going into this interview. I mean, it's essentially been a new album every 2 years since 2003 for the most part. And you're up to what, 10 studio albums? And in that time, you've only had one major member change. And, you know, one thing I always find fascinating doing these interviews, like, you know, the threads in what makes bands successful and what makes bands not successful. What, over all these years, 20 years of doing this band, what are some maybe tricks you've learned in communication or personal ways you've developed as a band that work for you, and things you may be able to like advise a younger band on?
Totally. I think consistency with what you're doing is really important. You know, I think like we've put out records consistently. Like, yeah, we the joke was we put one out every 2 years on the even years until we put out the record in 2020. We broke the cycle. Yeah. We fucked it all up. The whole world went out of whack.
Yeah. Like, it was your fault.
If only we'd put out that record in a few months earlier in 2019, then we would have been
no Rudy Gobert day.
Right. But no, I think the consistency when you're in a band is important. I think one thing we never did was chased any kind of trends.
Mm-hmm.
Tried to go into writing a record saying, okay, we're going to make like this kind of record because like this is popular right now. And I mean, you remember the fucking, some of the trends that have come and gone, like when bands were making, like putting dubstep in their music and
sure.
shit, like, you know, like how bad is that looking back, you know? So I think we were always conscious of that. And sure, we had some bad haircuts, but we never went like the full fashion, you know, stuff. Like, we were always pretty, you know, we were just like who we were, you
sure.
know? We never tried to be anything that we weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And just being real with not only each other, but also with our fan base and everything, and treating everybody with respect and not burning bridges and, you know, just trying to be nice to everybody. I think it just, that goes such a long way. In terms of like advice for younger bands, I think definitely like don't try to maintain like a level of we're all in this together. You know what I mean? And I know.
Do you mean between the members of the band or
between the members of the band? Like try you really like try to like
unified goals, maybe.
Yeah, really try to really try to be like unified on goals and have everybody in the band trying to play some kind of a role. Like obviously not maybe not everybody can write the songs, and maybe not everybody should write the songs.
Right.
But you know, like for example, in our band, like Billy, he's not gonna write our songs. He's written some great stuff. Don't get me wrong. He's not our main songwriter, but he is the guy. Like when it comes to what are we going to do with our vinyl on this pressing? You know what I mean?
Right.
Or like, what should our photography, you know, be like, you know, or there's so many things like that he does that is like incredible and really important, you know?
Right.
So every band, you know, besides just playing music, which obviously is the main thing you're doing, it's really good that everybody has kind of their own thing that they're passionate about.
Sure.
And on like, you know, the business side of it or whatever it is. And I think that that's really great too.
That makes sense. How open does the communication have to be to do that? Like, is it just like assumed and known that Bill does that stuff and he's good at it? Or is it communicated? Like, you know, is it like, hey, you're doing a really great job with this stuff? Like, is that idea of, you know, a little bit of reassurance, you know, you good, you think?
Yeah, I think so. But I also think like sometimes that stuff isn't so obvious. It's not so like apparent. Like you start a band, like, hey, you're going to be this guy and you're going to be this guy. And like, this is your role. Like it kind of falls into place.
Right.
You know?
Sure.
As of who does what and how much you feel, how much, you know, how much someone wants to do or whatever. Right. And it doesn't necessarily have to be so rigid with like, well, that's your fucking job. Why didn't you do your job?
Right.
Then you get into all sorts of other problems too.
Sure.
But no, I think the other thing too, we've always been very, I don't know, conscious of too, is we bring people on the road, like crew members and stuff. We treat them like the same as everybody else. Mm. Like, we treat a crew member like a band member. We don't like, I don't play the, well, I need the best place to sleep because I'm the singer card. You know, I don't like, I try not to pull any of that kind of diva shit, you know?
Right.
And like, we realize that our crew members are on the road and they're away from their friends and family, just like we are.
Sure.
And that's hard too, you know? So if crew guy wants to have his girlfriend out for a couple days, sure. You know what I mean? Like, nice. No problem. Like those kinds of things are, to me, are like fine. And a lot of bands wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
And I think treating your crew and the people around you, and that extends into, you know, all the people that are around your band, I think treating them all like family and like gold is just really important.
Yeah. That's awesome. So I just,
sorry, the long answer.
No, I appreciate it. It's one of the things I'm really fascinated on when I do the podcast, because there seems to be a really, you know, universal thread in the bands that, you know, do it for a long time with the same types of people. And they're really basic things, you know, it comes down to mutual respect, you know, hearing people, actually hearing people, letting people voice it, not feeling insecure, you know, sort of basic emotional things. But when you get groups of 4, 5, 6, usually young boys together at, you know, 17, 18, 19, like people don't have the wherewithal to always act accordingly, especially at first, you know?
Well, the other thing too, I should add is just don't take yourself so fucking seriously.
Right.
That's the other thing, man.
Sure.
Like, you're just like, put it into perspective what you're doing. Like you're a bunch of kids making noise that like 99% of the world thinks is shit, no matter how good it is. You know what I mean? Like, it's when I'm just talking about if you're playing in a punk band or something, right? Like, you're not, don't get on your high horse.
Right.
Just have fun, do your best, you know, Manage your expectations. Mm. Like when you get to when you're on the way to that show and the promoter's like, there's going to be 250 kids there. And then you get there and there's 25.
Right.
Just, you know, don't you tell yourself that there might be, you know, 50. And then if 100 show up, you're really excited
rather than
the other way around. You know, those kinds of expectation managing, I think, is really important as a band too.
Yeah, that makes sense. Managing expectations. That's big.
Exactly.
Yeah, it is.
Yep.
Interesting. So I just heard something and I have a feeling that Brad is going to chime in when he hears this. So recording drums last.
Yeah.
Please talk me off a ledge. Tell me how this works. Cause I was scared and a little offended and scared, mostly scared when I heard this. Can you tell me,
dude,
what's happening? Why it's good?
Let me tell you this. As a drummer, you should be so happy.
Tell me why.
Because there's a couple things.
Okay.
The reason generally I think that people want to record drums last now is because so much of the time when a band is working on a song, it changes, right?
Yeah.
It changes over time. Like maybe you rewrite the second verse and then the vocals are different.
Mm-hmm.
Or like maybe the singer will hold a note longer in one spot than like maybe the demo or something.
Right.
So if you already have the drums locked into place, then you can't change that later.
Right.
So like, let's say this, you want the singer to hold a note longer. And then right when that note stops, there's the drum fill.
Mm-hmm.
But like if instead you have it so that the singer, you know, like does the opposite and then the drum fill comes in like too early or whatever, then it could just be not as good. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention if you decide, actually, we really want to do this verse like halftime. It's like, well, sorry, it's recorded now. We can't
right.
We can't change that.
Okay.
You know, unless you want to go set up the kit again and record the drums.
Mm.
The other thing is a lot of bands will have, you know, a pretty limited budget for their record.
Right.
So it makes a lot more sense to have the whole thing done and have all the drums, you know, like, you know, you play to a click track. I don't know if Gaslight Anthem played exclusively to a click track or not, but like on your records. But if you have that all on a click and you have all the MIDI drums programmed and they can be changed, then the drummer has, first of all, the drummer has the whole time to learn them mm-hmm. during the whole recording so that they'll be really well in his mind of what he's going to do, or she will do, I should say. And then the final thing is like, okay, cool. Now that we know exactly what the drummer's going to do, we can bang out these drums in like 1 or 2 days because, you know, so it's like, okay, we only have to get the drum studio, like the big room, for like 2 days instead of maybe 3 or 4 days if you're still, you know, working at the drum parts or the ideas of the songs.
So when you're doing it, are you tracking guitars first?
So we'll kind of have everything in, like, from a demo. So we'll have, you know, like in Pro Tools or Logic or whatever we're using, we tend to use Pro Tools because our producer does. So we'll have like a demo with the guitars and the vocals, and then the drums will all be programmed. And then usually we'll start kind of replacing everything from the demo and making changes as we go.
Usually
we'll make sure that we like the song, and then we'll record guitar and bass first. And then the vocals to the MIDI drums, drums at the end. But for our last record, we didn't do it entirely like that. We kind of did it more like a few songs at a time.
Okay.
Rather than an entire record.
Yeah, I like doing that.
Yeah, but the thing is like there's no rules these days, really.
Right.
You know, with what you want to do.
I think
something like the drums that. And I mean, these days everything could be edited too. So like
right.
You could change stuff anyway, but
that's right.
Doing the drums first, it does, I think, put you in at a disadvantage if you want to change things.
It's interesting. Yeah. I'm not.
Does Brad agree?
Oh, I doubt it.
I've had enough of your ridiculous theories.
Yeah, Dad. Brad is like, if you think, I was joking with my wife. I'm like, I got the perfect question to piss off Brad tonight. Because he's probably sitting there going, you know what's great? Steely Dan, reel to reel, 2-inch tape.
Fuck you.
Ah, oh, your buzz is gone.
Oh, fuck you. Yeah, so, fuck you.
Now your buzz
is gone. Is it gone? Is the buzz gone?
No, still kind of
yeah,
there.
It's still
there. this is really dependent on the type of music and like what you're doing. Yeah, I mean, I get it. I've never heard of this technique. It sounds really interesting, but not everybody could do this, or and like you said, not every song would it work on.
See how mad Brad got when I brought up Steely Dan in regards to him. You know,
I mean, if you're recording it to music to a grid, like to a click track, which I mean, most stuff is, you can do it this way.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I understand. Like, I mean, it was a really, really weird for me the first time we did it too. I was kind of against it. And there was a record we did drums first, even like we talked about doing drums last time. We ended up doing the drums first just because we were all like, this is weird. And then we came around on it. So
yeah, listen,
we were the same way.
I'll try anything once besides for crack, you know? So if it came to it, I'll give it a shot. I'll give it a shot.
There you go.
The last single, that you put out, It's Over, really cool song. And I felt that is the last single, right?
Yeah.
Felt like it had a really kind of little bit of a different feel for you all and a kind of a different kind of heaviness to it, a little slowed down, a little thick. And I really like it. I dig it. Is this a bit of a precursor for the future of Silverstein?
I don't know. You know, it's always funny how whenever we make, you know, put out a new album or a new song or whatever, half the people say, oh, this sounds like exactly like their old stuff. The band never evolves. And then half the people are like, wow, this is like way different. Like
right.
What happened to the old stuff? You know, like it's like, no, you can never seem to win. Right. And it's funny because that song I thought was one of the more kind of classic Silverstein songs, but then a lot of things, I mean, we're tuning lower.
Yeah.
And, you know, and some of the, I don't know, it's just some of the production and stuff, I guess, probably makes it sound a little more modern. But that being said, yeah, we really like the song, and that's one of the reasons it's a single. And, you know, we got some other stuff up our sleeves we're excited about too that's, hopefully, you know, we are a band and we are an active band, so new music will be coming at some point.
Nice.
That's all I can really say. And we're excited about it. But I think people need to kind of throw whatever preconceptions they have of our band out the window.
Nice.
Because we have some stuff all over the map coming. From heavy to soft to everything in between. And that's exciting for us because we've always been that band. You know, we've always had a variety of music, which to answer your question about what's kept us afloat for so long with minimal member changes, I think the fact that we have a lot of tools in the toolbox that are fun to use.
Right.
I think that keeps it exciting for us too.
It's awesome.
Thanks, man.
Yeah. Well, you are a wonderful guy to talk to. I always enjoy what you're doing and enjoy pod. Yeah. So yeah. I appreciate you doing this. I hope you had a nice time time with us.
I love to talk, and I haven't seen you, Benny, in like forever.
It's been a dog's age.
Maybe wanna... And I mean, let's keep in touch. Let's talk ball. And
for sure.
Especially this NBA season. It's going to be very interesting in the Eastern Conference.
Oh yeah. I mean,
so
you saw the Nets. Just take it to the Bulls last night and show everyone what they're capable of. So,
like, are the Bulls real? I don't know. I'm not convinced.
I think they're a perimeter defender away, but that's for another pod. Brad's going to kill himself if I do that. But Shane, thanks a lot for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know, Brad. Recording drums first. You okay with this? Recording drums last? It's a tough sell, right?
You know what? The funny thing is that actually I'm not totally opposed to it. I get, like, I mean, at this point, this is real. You know what? The fact that this is like a new idea is really a testament to the way that records are made now, which is on the grid, in Pro Tools, like, because, you know, the way that you made records not that long ago, you know, I mean, through the 90s into the aughts, you know, people were still using tape for the most part. And, you know, rock bands, even hardcore bands, you know, you record it all together. And there's a reason you do that, because like anybody who's been in a room with a live drummer knows that like there's this tug and pull and give and take and all kinds of music. It's definitely way more prevalent in certain types of, I mean, there's certain music that you just couldn't make that way because, you know, like you can't like, you know, I mean, you know what I'm talking about. There's just like, there's a feel to playing live in a room. And I mean, everybody, like, you know, I think I really believe that most records everybody should record together in the room. And the things that he was talking about happen then, like the singer holds a note, the drummer like waits to do the fill, you know?
Right.
And that happens, you know, anybody who's recorded regularly like that knows that those things happen. And that's why you end up with multiple takes, you know, and you get,
see, I wonder, you know, we talk about this and I wonder if how much, you know, recording technology has actually changed songwriting. You know, because,
oh, definitely it has.
Even just the general concept of like going into the studio and still making major adjustments.
Yeah.
Like up until a few years ago, to me, that was an absolute no-go. Like if you had studio time booked,
you had to be ready.
Oh, yeah. You knew like what the fuck you were doing. Yeah. Like when you went in, no major changes, you know, like the song is the song by the time you get in there.
Yeah, but no, you're definitely correct about that.
It's with the totally way it's changed. Done now. I mean, you know, I just kind of dealt with this with the Mercy Union record. There was a couple songs we were going in with that weren't quite done, you know, had a couple extra pieces and stuff like that. And I decided to kind of let my old thinking go in regards to that and just be like, hey, we got it all there. I'll take a bunch of different passes. We'll figure out what's right. You know what? Like the end result, it's really fucking similar. So it's possible and I can see it. I can see it. I heard it and I was like, oh man, I got to make Shane explain this. But he's like 2 minutes into explaining. I'm like, eh, whatever. Makes sense. It's fine.
Whatever makes the best music, man.
That's it. Yeah.
I mean, if you have the means, you always have the option to do it the old-fashioned way. It's just, you know, and the truth is you can make good sounding records now without the means, which you couldn't do 20 years
ago.
So
right.
I am pro technology for that reason.
I mean, I guess a lot has to do too. I mean, it's like, it's not like they're recording with no drums, you know, they had a MIDI track. So, you know, they do have like an underlying thing keeping it going. It's not just these naked
and,
you know, bare guitar parts and bare vocal parts.
I'll tell you a secret. If you're anybody who's sort of a music historian will know that there are moments in history where the drums have been, you know, probably some famous songs that that we could dig up where this technique has actually been used, like on traditional, like rock and roll songs where the drums have been re-recorded for whatever reason.
Can you name names?
I can't like right now come up with a specific song, but I know that I have read about, you know, things where like, oh yeah, and then at 4 o'clock in the morning, Keith comes in completely wasted and decided that Charlie's track was just too on the beat and recorded all the drums over, you know?
Right. Yeah. Right.
There is definitely things that have happened like that. So
I love that shit. You ever heard that story about, the Bob Marley song and apparently the producer, I think it was I Shot the Sheriff, and you can hear a little bump in the track when you listen to it. And the myth is that the guy who recorded the record was not a weed smoker. But they just finished and they're like, yo, you got to smoke. And apparently he dropped the cherry of the joint on the reel to reel.
Ooh.
And burnt through.
No.
And had to splice a piece of I Shot the Sheriff. And that's why there's the little bump in that song. I could never tell you. You know, obviously I wasn't there. I don't know if it's
well,
true,
we both know that stranger things have happened in the studio.
I believe that's true. Well, Brad, you got some socials for our friend Shane?
So Shane is rich with socials. He can be found on Instagram and Twitter at Shane Told. You can get Silverstein exactly where you would expect them, at Silverstein. Lead Singer Syndrome, which I do recommend.
Yeah, very good.
Lead Singer Syn, S-Y-N, on Twitter, but Lead Singer Syndrome on Instagram. And then he's got an older Instagram account. I don't know if he still works with this, with River Oaks Music. But
yeah.
You can check that out, too.
Man.
And of course,
I got to hit up one of these Krampus parades, bro.
Did you see the picture I sent you?
Yes.
Yeah,
oh, my God. I would fight one of those creeps if they touched me with a stick, though.
It's definitely creepy.
That was a great story. But yeah, thanks a lot to Shane coming on and everybody. Yeah, keep in touch with Silverstein and Lead Singer Syndrome. He is a prolific creator, and I'm sure he's gonna have plenty of stuff coming our way.
Yeah, and you can support us at patreon.com/goingofftrack. We've got a lot of incentives there. You can check those out, and you can drop us a tip if you want on Venmo at Off Track. Thanks, Matt, for the tip this week. We'll take it.
And in about 12 minutes, we're starting the weekly Discord fireside chat with our awesome patrons, who it's really becoming a very nice place to go every week, huh?
It's a so nice little thing.
If anybody wants to join us and have our good friends in the forum give you a little therapy session, it's what we're good at. So come into our Discord via our Patreon. It's fun.
Yeah. And we'll see you next week.
Yeah. Enough of the whorish behavior. All right. Bye, Brad.
Bye.